welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Black women are certainly in the political spotlight these days. Stacey Abrams became the first black woman ever to give the official rebuttal to the State of the Union address. More than 20 black women now serve in Congress. That's a record. And according to one crowdsourced database, more than 450 black women ran for political office in 2018. And of course, Kamala Harris is mounting a run for the nation's highest office. Actually, you know, it bears looking at because black women have been driving political movements for decades, if not hundreds of years. As we mark Black History Month, we're taking a look today at black women whose contributions have been crucial to political and social movements and exploring how those legacies have paved the way for modern black female leaders. And looking ahead, what does the future hold for black women in politics? We are so grateful to be joined today by activist, scholar, and communications expert, Dr. Janet Duarte Bell. Her book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, captures the stories of 9 African-American women who advanced the civil rights movement, and she does it in their own words. Dr. Bell joins us from New York. Thank you so much for being here.
It is my pleasure to join you, Renee. Thank you.
You are so uniquely positioned to have this conversation at such a unique time in our history as Americans and as African-Americans and as women. So, again, just so grateful that you're here. You know, I was thinking as I was preparing to talk to you today, Janet, I was in Ghana a few years ago, and I did a series of interviews with the market women there. And I thought it was just, you know, women in the marketplace, but it turns out they were such a powerful political force. It was belied by the fact that when you just go through the markets, they're standing in the stalls next to their produce. But going all the way back to the days of Kwame Nkrumah, those market women wanted him to be the first post-colonial elected president of Ghana. The men were giving them pushback. So what did they do? They pulled all the produce out of the marketplace, right? Within 2 weeks, Kwame Nkrumah was elected the first duly elected president of Ghana. So this whole women, we've got it kind of thing goes back a long ways, yes?
It really does. Goes back to the women's club movement. Women, really, African-American women really were positioned to take roles, activists. I call them leadership roles in the civil rights movement, although others might not have recognized them as leaders at that time. And when you talk about the women in the marketplace, that's a great analogy to black women in churches and in clubs and who have organized these various family councils and what have you throughout our history. So black women in the marketplace really have taken care of business. I'd also like to say something. Not only have black women been a force for black women's advancement, they have always lifted the community. You know, they lifted as they climbed, and they were the inspiration, although not given the credit, for many of the white women's movements. And my friend Gloria Steinem does talk about that, that she got her experience and her leadership from people like Shirley Chisholm, and she really acknowledges the contribution that black women have made. So I think that the way we have led, we've led sometimes very seldom have we led as heads of organizations, although the sororities have been very, very active over the years. But we have led from the middle of the pack, from behind. We just did the work that needed to be done. Elaine Jones, the former head of the Legal Defense Fund, says black women just did the work.
And like you said, it was through existing church groups and social groups and sororities. Those kinds of kind of built-in organizational structures is how it got done.
And if there weren't organizational structures, they found a way to make a way out of no way. For example, during the bus boycott, when people needed to raise money, there is a woman who, she's not one of the women I interviewed because she, you know, I only interviewed people who were still alive a few years ago. But Georgia Gilmore, a cook, organized cooks and other day workers, service workers, to raise money, putting their jobs and their lives at risk to do this. So when there wasn't a way, I say they're in the spirit of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. When you think of, I mean, it really takes a lot of nerve to think you're going to go through hostile territory and lead people through, you know, to freedom on the Underground Railroad. I mean, that's the kind of spirit I think that black women have brought to organizing and to politics.
And they've had to do it fighting on two fronts, not just sexism, but racism also.
Yes.
Yeah, folks might kind of forget that, you know, African-American men were able to vote thanks to the 15th Amendment starting in 1870, but African-American women were still unable to participate in elections. And, you know, in the 1890s, when the suffrage movement began, it was still a period where African-American women were still not included in that suffrage. It took, like, till 1965 in the Voting Rights Act before African-American women finally were incorporated, although, you know, they certainly were pushing into the suffrage movement, yes?
Well, when we got the right to, the quote, the right to vote the same time that white women did. And but for the early suffragist movements, I didn't realize until recently that black women really inserted themselves in that first suffragist large march. They and the white women did not want us to be a part of it. And they said, no, 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 we are going to be a part of it. Somehow they were probably... there was that dynamic, not just among black men or men, but also there's always been that dynamic with white women that we have to continually build coalitions and also keep people moving along in our interest, not just concede other people's interests, but moving people along in our interests, the interests of black people, black women, which has always been about community and uplifting the race, as it were.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to that famous Sojourner Truth speech in Akron, Ohio, kind of my stomping grounds where I grew up, Ain't I a Woman, where she talked about white women's privilege and the courtesies that they were afforded and the opportunities that were not given to African-American women.
And also that was really almost a trick and a sham when you think about it, that white women somehow felt that they were absolved from the kind of sexism that, you know, and people didn't analyze it the way we're doing it, but this kind of sexism that black women also were facing. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you look at the 2016 election, that wasn't about sexism, that was about racism. I tell people that, and they go, well, how can you say that? Well, I look at it, and what, over half of white women who voted for Donald Trump for president. That is astounding to me. And the fact that he still has support from women, given his clear policies of being anti-woman and also anti the values that women claim that they support. It's amazing to me. So I always say the basis that racism allows sexism to flourish.
You get a lot of pushback when you make that distinction.
I sure do.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about it. Tell me about the pushback that you get when you make that distinction.
I respect very much Shirley Chisholm, who was, when someone asks her, I believe, was she discriminated against because she was black or because she was a woman, which came first? And she did not make the kind of distinction that I do. But the reason I say is that certain white women, and I don't want to paint too broad a brush, because I've been involved in the women's movement as well as the civil rights movement and the peace movement. My mom had me marching, passing out flyers for Adlai Stevenson in 1952. So I've been been supporter of politics and progressive issues for a long, long time. But the reason I say that that racism fuels that is because white women have been complicit. I mean, how do you not know? For example, in in the South, how do you not know when there is a, you know, even during, let's say, the time of slavery and Jim Crow, that somehow some of those children in the slave quarters start to look a lot like your family? And you, how do you look the other way with that? And how does that have an impact on the way you look at life? You know, there are pictures of lynchings, and there's one famous picture. You know, lynchings were family affairs. There were community gatherings where they would take black men, mostly black men, but also women and children, but they were fascinated with black men's genitalia for some reason. And they would take them, and there's this one photo, and this one woman, this white woman, is looking kind of askew at the camera. And you could see she knew this was wrong, but what could she do about it? Or what would she do about it? So I applaud the fact that Bryan Stevenson, you know, his racial justice initiative has this memorial to lynching, because if we ever solve the issue of lynching, if we're able to talk about that in an honest way, and how racism has become part of this country's DNA, and what we have to do to get rid of it. I mean, you can't solve a problem if you don't call it what it is.
And it was Ida B. Wells who called it what it was, who wrote about the scourge.
Wasn't she fascinating? And she did it without an entourage. I mean, when we talk about black women who, I mean, she wrote about lynching, right, as a journalist, but she was also there. I mean, her life was in jeopardy. So she took the risk to tell the truth. And so what we have to do is remind people as they're going out, and there's some wonderful women, black women candidates who've been in political races over the last few years, and partly we want to remind them that they come from a mighty strong heritage, and they have to live up to the people like Ida B. Wells, who put their lives on the line, women in the civil rights movement who put their lives on the line to tell the truth, to move ours, not just move black women forward, move our society forward to that very elusive, more perfect union.
Wasn't it lovely after the last midterms when the African-American women newly elected each took her turn in front of the painted portrait of Shirley Chisholm at the National Museum? And, you know, she had her own pose in the portrait, and each one of them assumed that same position and took her place in front of that portrait. I thought, how poignant is that? And wouldn't Ms. Chisholm have been just thrilled that we have come so far, and that 2018 might have been something of a turning point? Let's talk about the results of the midterms.
I hope so. Can I say one other thing about a very courageous member of Congress who's in your area, of course, Barbara Lee?
Oh, yes.
Had the courage to vote no after everyone was apoplectic and what have you after 9/11. But Barbara Lee has been there all the time, and she got involved in politics helping to run Shirley Chisholm's California campaign.
So I was one of the was alone, right? I think that was she was the only no vote to the Iraq War vote. Yes,
she was. Mm-hmm. She was it.
Talk about courage, standing alone.
Yes, and
she
has kept that courage over the years. She's always been engaged and determined. I think she's one of the most ethical people that I've ever met.
Yeah, around here you see a lot of bumper stickers. Barbara Lee speaks for me. So, yeah, she's got a very, very supportive constituency. And so not only do more black women serve in Congress than ever before, she has lots of company in Congress now, but many of them broke records and defied expectations in their individual races. I'm reminded of Ayanna Pressley. She defeated a 10-term Democratic incumbent and a power broker in the Democratic Party back in September, and then became the first black woman from Massachusetts to join Congress. Mm-hmm. So I think everybody kind of clutched their pearls like, what does this mean?
And Lauren Underwood, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these women are just extraordinary. They have set the pace for other people, and they didn't necessarily do it easily. You know, and also we talk about black women having laid the groundwork for some of this. There have been a lot of people over the years, nameless, faceless, we'll never really know who they are, who really helped set the stage for this. But even in Democratic politics, there are a lot of us have been saying, you know, let's move the women forward. We're not just window dressing.
You know,
we want to have seats at the table, and we're earning those seats at the table. So what you saw that was also part of that wave in the midterm elections was you saw groups such as Higher Heights, which is a black women's group focusing on black women candidates. You had Emily's List. Some have been on Emily's List, and I'm not speaking on behalf of these organizations, just about these organizations, even though I've been supportive of them. But Emily's List supported a lot of these women that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I was impressed at the extent to which African-American women began running for office, because it was as if a sleeping giant was awakened. Suddenly, people who had never even considered running for public office, teachers and others, Lucy McBath in Georgia's 6th mm-hmm. District, whose son was shot and killed because he was sitting in a car at a gas station where their music was too loud, and he was shot and killed. All of a sudden, Lucy McBath, who may never have seen herself in public office, flipped a seat that had been Republican for nearly 40 years. So to what extent do you think that circumstances are wakening the sleeping giant?
I think that you said some of those, but when we look at the voting patterns of black women, we look at Doug Jones, for instance. I think way over 90% of black women who voted for Doug Jones. We were not fooled at all. You know, mm-hmm. we saw through any opposition, and we have to then hold his feet to the fire. He turned around and voted for, I've forgotten which bill it was that black women did not necessarily support. But, you know, people aren't going to vote all the way that you want, but we have to hold their feet to the fire. But I think black women, seeing how we've been and people have been giving us lip service for years, saying, oh, you know, we're such a strong force in the Democratic Party. And now black women are saying, well, okay, we can count the numbers now. Over 90% Doug Jones, a large percentage for this candidate or that candidate. We want to run ourselves. And they're not waiting, sitting around asking for permission.
You're talking about Doug Jones, who defeated Roy Moore in the Alabama Senate race.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
The first time that people started to actually recognize the extent to which African-American women were actually the catalyst that actually made that happen. I know that was the first time that I had actually heard it out loud. I think, you know, organizers have known for years that this is a reliable voting bloc. But that election was the first time that I actually heard it acknowledged.
Well, it was so stark that they could not ignore that. The numbers were so high, mm-hmm. and the fact that any woman would support Roy Moore is just or any black person of color, it's just fast. It's just flabbergasting to me.
Well, it drew some stark lines, that's for sure.
I think sometimes you have to have some clear choices or stark lines. And I'm not one of those people who, I try to be measured. You know, I have a doctorate. I know how to do research and how to be balanced and that. But sometimes there's right and wrong, and you have to call it the way it is.
This is one of those subjects, Dr. Bell, that folks want to weigh in on, so I'm going to invite them to do so.
Good.
We're talking to Dr. Janet Duarte Bell, and the number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. And we're talking about African-American women and their role in politics, past, present, and future. Are there black women running for office or running powerful political organizations in your area that you'd like to highlight? Do you think America is ready for black women to assume leadership roles and more political power more visibly? Because certainly behind the scenes, that has been the case for many decades. But it's a lot more visible now. 866-798-8255 is the number. You can write us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. So, Dr. Bell, what did the midterms, the 2018 midterms, tell us about the political viability of black women candidates?
That black women candidates not only have the right stuff, they know how to go outside of their base. They know how to use coalition politics because they realize, I mean, some of these black women that ran and won ran in predominantly white areas. And so what they did was they talked about values that are important to not only the black community, but, you know, black community values should be important to everybody because we are the ones who, despite the history of slavery, Jim Crow, discrimination, income inequality, all that stuff, black women still are flag wavers. My late mother was a flag waver forever, and she grew up in the rural South, went north. She would take the bus in Erie, Pennsylvania, which there was often snow. You know, the snow was everywhere. It was cold for election day, but she never missed voting. That's the kind of black women, you know, that's the kind of history that not only I have, but a lot of black women have. We know that we have dues to pay. Other people paid some dues, but we have to pay dues for those coming after us. And so I think what the election says is that, okay, how do we talk about issues that are impact and not be as, you know, in my neighborhood, not a very academic term, but they would talk about people who talked out of both sides of their mouth as mealy mouthed, right?
And yep. I've heard that so, before, yeah.
You've heard that before, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't be that. The times are so, the times demand courage, authenticity, people who are willing, and also people who are willing to do the work, who are willing to set aside their own personal, you know, it's a conundrum, right? Because you have to have a lot of ego to put yourself out there and run for office. That's clear. But on the other hand, you have to submerge that ego on behalf of the good of the community writ large.
Mm-hmm. You gave a shout out to your mom. And, you know, I think people, when they hear about the contributions of African-American women in politics, you know, there are the obvious names, the Cynthia McKinneys and the Shirley Chisholms and the Carol Moseley Braun's. But, you know, there are also women like your mother and mine, Alice Kemp. You know, we're from Cleveland. She helped get Carl
Let's
Stokes.
Lift her up, yes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
She worked to get Carl Stokes elected, the first black mayor of a major American city in Cleveland. And I watched as a kid what that looked like, organizing behind the scenes, block by block, street club by street club. And it worked just as well now as it did then. It's the groundwork that has always been laid by African-American women toiling in the vineyards unseen.
And you know what you said about your mom is that, and that a lot of people of that era, what have you, and those of us and who have observed that said, wait a minute, wait, we do that for, and we've done that for other people. Time we could do a little bit of that for ourselves. But we also have to overcome, as you stated earlier, the not only the, you know, the racism, the sexism, but then there's a little thing like getting people to donate money to your campaign because you still and. Since we don't have campaign financing, you still have to raise a lot of money. So there are a number of issues that black women candidates have to consider, face, and overcome. But I think that people are learning more how to do that. They're willing to do the work, and the most important thing is willing to put themselves out there. Because as soon as they get out there and they announce, no matter how qualified they are, people start trying to marginalize them and to make them one-dimensional or something like that. You know, it's interesting. And I know you do a lot about image of women. But, you know, I was interested in reading a headline the other day, or maybe it was just a comment, where they called Kamala Harris essentially the call-out queen. I said, wait a minute, what's that?
What's that mean?
I said, because her willingness to call out things that she does not like, or to call out the things particularly that number 45 does. Now, while that may be true, don't try to label her like that. She is a dynamic senator. And so one of the things that black women, I think, in politics and any other public sphere have got to watch out is not being caricatured, mm-hmm. not being marginalized, not being considered just one thing. Moving on from there, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. There's so much of that to talk about. The whole idea of the sort of cardboard cutout character is created when it comes to black women in politics. That's what we're talking about today with Dr. Janet Dwart Bell. And we're going to talk about a bit more right after this break. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea, please drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Tomorrow, on the Friday Media Roundtable, we're going to talk about how the media covers lobbyists and special interest groups. And we're going to review Governor Gavin Newsom's first State of the State address and his vision for the future. Today, we are talking about the political impact and the political future of African American women. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can give us a call. Are there black women running for office or for powerful positions or institutions in your area? And what do you think of the whole characterization that Dr. Bell and I were talking about before the break? Dr. Janet Bell is the author of Lighting the Fires of Freedom. And there's this whole idea that anger works as a catalyst for African-American women in politics. 866-798-8255. You know, you write about Merle Evers as one of the six women, Dr. Bell, that you profile. And Merle Evers told you about the power of anger, and said in the interview that anger was a blessing, that it saved her. And I think about Carol Moseley Braun, the first African-American woman in the United States Senate. She said it was anger about then Democratic Senator Alan Dixon, who had voted to confirm Clarence Thomas, despite his sexual harassment claim, that angered her into running for the Senate in Illinois. So tell us how anger saved Merle Evers and how that has become a political catalyst.
Well, for Mrs. Evers, who I had the great, great privilege of interviewing, I assume everyone knows her story, but then I've been speaking a lot around the country, and I realize I actually have to give people a little bit of background, that her husband, Medgar Evers, who was the first NAACP field secretary in the state of Mississippi, was assassinated in their driveway in 1963, essentially in front of her and their three small children. And she used her, not only her anger, but her love to seek justice for the murder of her husband, and that assassination that took almost 30 years for justice to be done. Everybody knew who did it, but you just couldn't get a conviction. But what she did, but in terms of how she channels that anger into positive things. And I have to say, my late husband, Derek Bell, would say, if you aren't angry sometimes, you're just not paying attention. And so she's channeled that anger into going back to school because she wanted to fiercely take care of her three children. She went back to school at age 31, got a doctorate. She ran for Congress twice. And, I mean, long before a lot of these women we were talking about ran for Congress, of course, and unwisely, she was not elected. But the fact that she would do that, I said to her, I said, Mrs. Evers, I think you've done enough. I mean, she became chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. That's an elected position, and that was a hard fought win for her. But she has, she has taken the, without becoming that angry black woman. I mean, when you see her, you see this beautiful smile. You see the fact. I mean, when she did the invocation at President Obama's second inauguration, you see the measure of the woman. She's a full woman. But, that anger at injustice is what propels her.
But talk about the powerful stereotype that still exists. We remember right after President Obama's first inauguration, the magazine cover showing Michelle Obama with a big afro doing a fist bump.
Kamala the New Yorker, yes.
Yeah, the New Yorker cover. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris is the call-out queen. What is that? Why do you think that persists? Why is it such a powerful and negative stereotype still?
Because I think people are still, it's that intersection of racism and sexism, and people are afraid that somehow, my mother used to say, somehow they're afraid that when black women take over, we probably would do to them what they or their families have done to us. That is not true at all. That has never been the case. It's never been retribution. It's been understanding, even to the point of self-sacrifice for many black people to understand our history and then overcome that. But I think it's another way of saying to black women, you stay in your place. We don't want you to do certain things. I mean, they even, speaking of Michelle Obama, I mean, wasn't it Mitch McConnell? Someone commented on her physique. I mean, really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you think you have the right to comment on the physique of the First Lady of the United States, a black woman? He hasn't done that for anybody else, nor should he. I mean, I don't want equality of bad things to mm-hmm. happen to people.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was even a coined term, just talking about the difference between how white women who forged their way in politics actually has been so different from the route that African American women have taken in politics. There was even a term that was coined by black feminist Moya Bailey called misogynoir. Not misogyny,
oh, okay.
But misogynoir.
Misogynoir.
Mm-hmm. People who have to deal, women dealing with both race and gender biases. And the difference in how it plays out, whether you are working to elect someone or running yourself. I'm wondering the extent to which African-American women tend to organize campaigns and become king makers, always kind of working behind the scenes. How has that script been flipped most recently, do you think, from working behind the scenes, toiling in the vineyards, and becoming king makers to becoming actual candidates and queens?
Yes, well, I think it's taken a lot of work, and it will still take a lot of work. There's not been such a change that we can't pay attention to how we got there, and the fact that there's still a lot, and there's some resistance from other women, and this happens too sometimes. And so I think my thing is, you talk about calling it out, call it what it is, and talk about how we have to, as women, we have to continually say that we need to support each other In particular, black women need to be supported by other black women, other people, of course, but black women have to support that. Because if we don't, there will be, I mean, we have this euphoria now. But I remember the euphoria when President Barack Obama was first elected. And I was at, speaking of, you're from Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And I was a volunteer for about a total of 6 weeks in the Columbus area. I figured that I could do that because I had family in that area. And I remember calling back on election night to my family, to my husband, who was watching the election results back in New York City. And I remember saying, now the work has just begun. In other words, you know, the price of freedom, which he knows, of course, is eternal vigilance. We cannot sit back and think, okay, this is such a great thing, because there will be people like the Trump Republicans, Mitch McConnell, and those gangs, you know, who are up scheming late at night, early in the morning, to try to take away the kinds of gains that people that have, and they will be cutting deals with people like who claim that they have our best interests at heart, but we have to continually have our best interests at heart and always expand the base, always expand the tent, get more people in our tent, show them. We have to be transparent as to how we're working on behalf of the people, the districts that are represented, the states that are represented, and in the case of possibly President Kamala Harris, the people she might represent as president. So we have got to let people know, but also not be the one thing that has always that's one of the things that's very difficult for black politicians is to articulate the specific needs of the black community and in the context of the whole community. Because as soon as you start saying something, they'll go, special interest. Well, you know, income inequality is a reality. The history of our economic system has been rigged that means that black women are still not making close to a dollar, right? As other people are, they're still on the bottom of the income list. You know, those kinds of things, you have to talk about that. And what I find encouraging is that now that there's a critical mass of black women and other women of color in Congress, I think that's going to allow some of our white friends to talk more about and to support more efforts to do things like reduce income inequality, address issues of affordable housing, do things like that. So I think as we show that the power of not only of the power of the black vote, but the power that the black vote has to get women, black women, in leadership positions, then I think that that's going to be something that, you know, I hope we reach a point where we can see progress will continue to go, but we've got to remain vigilant so that there are always people trying to figure out ways to undermine that.
You're listening to Dr. Janet Duarte Bell. Thanks for staying through while I mangled your name there, Janet. Dr. Janet
that's quite
Duarte
all right.
Bell. She's the author of Lighting the Fires of Freedom, and we're talking African-American women in politics. 866-798-8255 is the number. Hi, Rodessa in San Francisco. Thanks for waiting. Go right ahead.
Oh, this is fabulous. I'm loving this show. And it moves me. I just have some comments about my own mother, who has since passed on. But I just remember the first day that my mother spoke out about her own life as an African-American woman living in Georgia at the turn of the century. And she talked about, we were all like complaining about Rodney King having been beat on television. And I think it was an Easter Sunday, and my friends here, the Rainbow Tribe of my friends, I'm very lucky that I have all these folks. But everybody's going on and on, and my mother's sort of sitting there, and she finally says very quietly, well, she says, white folks got to realize that it ain't slavery time no more. And everybody kind of stopped, you know. And she said, you know, because when I was a girl, they took us to lynchings. They made us watch. You could not turn away. She said, there'd be a man with a shotgun pointed at you. She said, I was 9 years old, and I saw my neighbors be have their genitals cut out. She said, I saw this. And at the same time, my mother was a wonderful, Estella Jones was my mother's name, and she, my mother was an incredibly gracious woman. And I think as I'm listening to this show about the trauma, that the historical trauma, and at the same time, it isn't about you know, retribution with us. I've been moved to vote. My mother would say, I don't want to write in my vote. I want to stand at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I want to stand with the people. I want to be seen as one of the people. And she would have loved Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. She didn't live to see them, but she would have loved it. And I just want to say thank you so much for this show. Just thank you, because it opens my heart. And I'm thinking about running for office at some time. Oh. Right now I'm an activist in San Francisco. I work with incarcerated women. I have the Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women. But as we're talking, I'm thinking maybe it's just time to make that move, you know. And
Well, we heard it here first. That's Well, that's excellent. Let me just say that one of the things that you did that I'm so happy with is that you mentioned your mother's name. You know, I'm an oral historian, and I, you know, my concentration is leadership and change. And what I always tell people, it is so important to say the name, to lift it up. Mm-hmm. So Renee mentioned her mother. You mentioned her mother. Tell their names. That always just gives me such a thrill to hear people do that.
It's extraordinary.
Thank you for your call.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Odessa.
If we speak their names, they live forever.
Yes, indeed.
Okay?
Thank you,
have
Odessa.
A good day.
You too. 866-798-8255 is the number. You know, I was interested in your discussion before the break. We started talking, Janet, about how there has to be a shift from not just racial identity politics, but class issues. And kind of stepping across racial, cultural, ethnic lines and forming a coalition. It's really interesting. The Root recently profiled Maya Rupert. She's managing Julian Castro's campaign for president. Donna Brazile managed Al Gore's. Maggie Williams came on toward the end of Hillary Clinton's run in 2008. So the idea that you identify a candidate that you can get behind and then work really hard for that candidate. And more you start to see that African-American women are at the forefront of running these campaigns.
Running the campaigns and then behind the scenes doing strategy, but they actually have to listen to us a little bit more in terms of some of the strategy. When we talk about, you know, the economic disparities and what have you, back to my mother, Willie Mae Neal, let me say her name. She used to say the vote is so powerful, because in those days, goes to show you the era, she said, your vote is as important as Rockefeller's vote. That's what she would say. Mm. And that's how she would organize people and inspire people to vote. And one thing that I was trying to explain, I don't know if I did it really well, with some of the candidates who were running in the midterms and also in 2016 and 2018, mostly 2016, was that, you know, it's that we need, it's not the talented 10th, you know, like Du Bois says, it's it's all of us. Everybody has to be involved. And so I hear people and they'd say, oh, well, let's get the university women involved. Well, I love university women. But I love the people who are doing the welfare organizing, the people who are cleaning the offices, what have you. They have voting rights too. Once they start exercising those voting rights, they are probably the most loyal people, loyal voters that they are. Now that is totally anecdotal, but I will stand by that.
How does that play into your concept of what you call a servant leader?
Yes, people who don't stand around, wait for credit for the work, but figure out that the work needs to be done. and who sometimes answer the call. You know, they can be people. Sometimes they are people who are in leadership positions. Be it, let me mention Eileen Hernandez, who was a student leader at Howard University. She started Howard University during segregation. And I have to remind people that Howard University, being in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, was below the Mason-Dixon line and still had the same kind of segregation and what have you. So Eileen Hernandez, and at that time a lot of the women, because the men were off at war, they took leadership positions in desegregating Washington, D.C. So, but she always considered herself as someone who was helping someone else. She never sought a title just for herself, even though she became the first and sadly the only black woman elected the president of the National Organization for Women, a position that she resigned from now, by the way, when after she was elected, they fielded a all-white slate. And she said, what? And so that's what I mean by we can't, you know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Even among our friends, you have to say, no, you can't turn back. It's not numerical integration or diversity, but it's diversity. And, you know, people know better than that.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many rising stars, too many to mention all of a sudden, which is a wonderful thing.
Isn't that nice?
It is. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at Stacey Abrams, for example, a rising Democratic star, hugely visible in American politics in the last midterms, the fact that she currently doesn't hold an elective office because she lost the governor's race. You've hosted fundraisers for folks who lost their races. Nina Turner, once again, in my backyard, who was running for Secretary of State in Ohio, Donna Edward. There are several people who come to mind who run but run unsuccessfully, but their visibility has been raised. So what's the value in even an unsuccessful run by these African-American female candidates?
I think that they become role models, because the women that I've supported have really put themselves out there and shown the way. They've shown courage. And so sometimes I've supported candidates who I know are—I always call a sure thing, like Barbara Lee. My husband and I had her first New York City fundraiser. I love Barbara Lee, but others you just do because it's the right thing to do. Because if you don't do it, who will do it? And sometimes the guys—and they are the guys. Mm-hmm. Are sitting around waiting for you to waiting to see what is your first quarter report for your financial. Do you have enough financial support? Well, it's not just financial support. And sometimes, as we've seen with the midterms, that you get out there and you figure out a way to go on every to knock on doors or do social media in a way that gets people to the polls. So I think if there's people like the caller who said she's thinking about running, mm-hmm. you know, tell people you can't run and, you know, I always say to people, you run to win. Mm-hmm. But even if you know that you're running, that you're tilting against that windmill, right, you still need to do it. I admire that so much.
Run anyway.
That people say, mm-hmm. run anyway.
Mm-hmm. Certainly looking ahead in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Dr. Bell, what does the future hold for black women in politics? We would be remiss in not talking about the fact that we've got a woman who is on the ticket, Kamala Harris. Is the country ready? That's the obvious question, so I'll just pose it. Is the country ready for an African-American female president?
My honest answer is I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say, but I'm cautiously optimistic. She clearly is as qualified as anyone who has already jumped in the ring and who will jump in the ring. There is no question about her qualification. But it's one of those things, I think, where you look at, you know, there are all these factors that are involved. First of all, there are her policies. You have, they will be compared against other people. There's the stump presence. So all of these factors that are involved. But on the other hand, too, there are people who are still licking their wounds, I think, because of the the reconstruction after the Obama presidency. So I think she's going to have a tough time, but if there's anybody who can do it, she can do it. She certainly will have I think she'll have the money, she'll have the support, she'll have broad kind of support, but I can say that for other people. And I think the one thing that I think if I were giving a recommendation, which I've not been asked to do, is to just be, to make sure that the authenticity comes across, that there are clear policies that help people, and that those things come across. So, yes, I think that she, I'm cautiously optimistic that she has a good chance.
And that the country might actually be ready.
And that the country might actually be ready, and that we can figure out all of these voter suppression things so that, you know, Hillary Clinton got the majority of the votes, right, but still lost. I put lost in quotation marks, that kind of thing. Stacey Abrams should have won, but for the votes that were taken away by Brian Kemp, who was running the Board of Elections at the same time he was running against her for governor of Georgia.
Right.
Now, clearly, someone knew that was not the right thing. And so,
Janet DeWart-Bell,
it's just amazing.
We're going to wrap you up. There is
always so much to talk about.
I have loved talking to you so much. Dr. Janet DeWart-Bell, thank you so much. Social justice activist, producer, author of Lighting the Fires of Freedom. Your call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. Laura Winnis is the producer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's your call.